This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Infinite Consciousness This Week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have a really interesting guest. His name is Stephen Buhner, and we're going to talk about his book, The Natural Testosterone Plan, how it relates to prostate, and some orders related to women. How are you, Stephen?
I'm fine. Hi, Eva. Thanks for having me on.
I'm so glad to have you. This is a great book.
Thanks.
It really is. So before we get started, why don't you tell people a little bit about you and how you come to write what you wrote in this book? What is your background?
Well, I grew up actually in a very conservative medical family that included a Surgeon General of the United States, a president of the Kentucky Medical Association, and basically was taught extremely conservative ideas about healing and medicine until I got out in the world. And the 60s kind of began to change my focus, but like a lot of people, I got into generally into the kind of humanistic growth movement, but like a lot of people, I came to herbs when I myself got sick and physicians couldn't help me. And I was kind of shocked to find out that a lot of the things I'd been taught about herbal medicine was pretty much lies. And it had to do with more of a one political group trying to control healing, which I found very upsetting since I actually liked my relatives a great deal. And so I began getting more and more involved in that. And I suppose since 1977 or so, I've been very involved in alternative health as a psychotherapist and as an herbalist and working with cross-cultural contemplative religious practices. So this particular book, I began working intensely with herbs, I guess, in about 1986 or 87, and this book happened, of course, when I began to go through my own middle age shift. I'm 55 now, and that kind of transition, even though I'd sort of heard it in a joking way, talked about, you know, men buying sports cars and stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, when it hits you, I mean, it just takes all of your attention, and there's definitely something happening, and I was shocked to find there was so little literature on it. So that's how this particular book emerged.
Well, that's a very good book. Where do you, where can people find you?
I live in New Mexico, and but I do have a website which people can get to from any place, and that's www.gaianstudies.org, GAIANstudies.org.
And do you have an email address?
It's at that address, Stephen, with a PH, at okay. GaianStudies.org.
And where can they get a copy of this book? It's written.
Oh, they have it pretty much everywhere. I sell them from my website. Amazon.com has them, of course, and Barnes & Noble and a lot of the bigger bookstores seem to carry it as well.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the testosterone and men. Is it normal or is it simply common for the testosterone to start lowering in middle age?
It's very common, and it's supposed to lower. It's, you know, in my work years as a psychotherapist, I worked a lot in a field called transactional analysis and working with basically developmental ego states or developmental ages, and all of us recognize those changes. I mean, we all know a newborn baby is different than a 9-month-old, and a 2-year-old has a very different kind of personality than a 4-year-old, and these kind of developmental stages are biologically encoded to emerge at certain times, and body chemistry shifts throughout that process as well. And everybody knows that when children move into adolescence, something happens. There's this kind of force of personality that begins to emerge that's very unique. Most people in our culture have no idea how to deal with it, so there's a lot of problems and conflicts. But nevertheless, there's a kind of a certain personality that emerges, and at that time, the body chemistry shifts too. And men, testosterone production begins to go way up in adolescence. And, you know, a thing that's not very well known is that when male babies are in the womb, they produce a lot of testosterone, and it's not uncommon for them to have erections in the womb. And 4 or 6 months to a year, perhaps, after they're born, they'll commonly have erections because testosterone production is fairly high then. So, but then what happens is, as we get into this adolescent phase and it kind of normals out, the male produces a lot of testosterone, and then they're going along, and sometime between the age of 40 and 55, that'll begin to shift, and this kind of new developmental stage begins to emerge. There's this kind of new archetype of self, that, or an ego state, that's biologically encoded to emerge in middle age, and our culture knows even less about that than how to deal with adolescence. And then at that point, the whole testosterone dynamic begins to shift in the male body, and part of that is this substance called free testosterone, which is the testosterone in the blood that's more biologically active, that begins to lower a little bit, and that's a completely normal process.
Now, what are the symptoms of that? How would somebody recognize it?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you how I first recognized it, and it's more social than anything else, but then there's a lot of common things that go along with it, too. You know, as we're growing and becoming sexually active, it's very common for people to flirt with each other and, you know, just this kind of eye contact expressing interest, not necessarily that you're going to do anything about it. And for me, what happened, I was mildly flirting with a young woman the way I'd done for, you know, most of my life, and her eyes said back to me, you know, you're old enough to be my father. And that's kind of the moment where a lot of men find that. It's like, almost like the social structure around the man begins to feed back a little bit of recognition of his changed state, really before he consciously begins to grasp it. And from that point on, it becomes a fairly rapid kind of recognition of the shifts. The men get tired a lot more easily. The skin wounds don't tend to heal as fast. They're a lot slower. If you get worn out, it takes more to come back. Like, I periodically restore houses and build furniture, just one of the things that I like to do. And it takes me longer to build up muscle mass, and I lose it a lot faster than I ever did. And those things are an irritant. The brain quits functioning with as much alertness and acuity, so it's harder to remember people's names and tiny details and things. And there's not as much kind of immediate energy boost. If you want to do something, it takes longer to get wound up to do it. And interestingly enough, if you look at the kind of complaints women have from going through menopause, and you look at the things that men talk about going through andropause, the list is actually almost identical.
Very interesting. So why does it, one of the things I've noticed in your book is that it starts out higher in the morning and decreases throughout the day. In other words, most men have more of a sex drive in the morning and not at night. Why does that happen? And what?
Well, I think part of it is that testosterone is used up a lot during the day, and when you rest at night, there's a lot of things that the body produces that you kind of use up during the day, which is one of the reasons why I suppose we get so tired and have to go to sleep again, you know, at night. But that's one of the dynamics. And, you know, normally the body produces testosterone in the male testes and in the adrenal glands, but it also produces it in the brain and also in peripheral tissues as it's needed. There's kind of prototype chemicals that are used, or pro-hormonal chemicals that are used to convert to testosterone when the body needs it. And there's a lot of different ways the body does that, but it starts to lose its vitality as we age, and it just doesn't produce as much of it, especially with the kind of diet and lifestyle and kind of chemical assaults that we've experienced in this culture for so long.
How important would it be to have the precursor DHEA?
Well, there's, I think precursor DHEA is a natural substance produced in the body, and it's extremely important that the body produce it. There's kind of a long, complicated sequence that I describe in the book about, you know, the primary chemical that, or the primary, you know, substance that we take in from our food that gets made eventually into sexual hormones like testosterone is cholesterol. And that's what starts it. It goes from cholesterol to pregnenolone to, and through these various steps, and DHEA is one of the earlier ones on there. And so there's supposed to be fairly high levels of all of these substances in the body. They're kind of the pro-hormones that the body uses to do various things. And through various channels, the body can take a pro-hormone into a various different ways. It can create an estrogenic chemical in the body, which is also necessary. We have that in our bodies just like women do. Or it can take it more into testosterone, and it can stop it at certain points because DHEA does certain things that pregnenolone doesn't, that testosterone doesn't, for instance. So that's one of the ways to check the vitality of your particular hormonal structure is to look at DHEA levels in this other kind of stored form of DHEA, DHEA sulfate. So that's important, and so some studies have shown if people take that particular supplement, it will increase testosterone levels and kind of overall well-being. And so it is a very important pro-hormone.
Is that something that if you, somebody going to a typical Western medicine doctor that they would know how to help them with?
You know, that's you have to remember that, you know, 50% of the doctors graduated in the bottom half of their class. So, I mean, you know,
right.
A lot of these guys are not the sharpest knives in the drawer, and they're not really trained to think deeply about problems, except, you know, there's certain specialists that are. But in general, most Western doctors are not very knowledgeable about things like this. I mean, most physicians can spend less than 8 minutes per client, and what they really do is they're trained to dispense pharmaceuticals.
Right.
And
I hate that.
That's not really the way it used to be. You know, my closest relative was my great-grandfather, who began medical practice in 1911, and he used mostly botanic medicines because that's mostly what they had then, and he spent a long time with all of his patients. You know, he'd spend 20 minutes to an hour with a patient, getting to know them and getting to know what was wrong and visiting them in their homes so he could see what kind of environment did they really live in. Is it going to produce health or disease or what? So he really was functioning as a healer, not this kind of guy that just people, you know, I mean, a doctor spending 8 minutes with somebody, they're seeing, you know, what, 1,000 people a day or something. It's not, they don't have time to look in depth. So there are certain physicians that are starting to really focus on this, and they're beginning to understand it. But by and, you know, large, the very few physicians, if you just went to a general doctor, they would make several mistakes, probably right off the bat. The first one is they might take a blood test to test for your testosterone levels, but most physicians don't understand that they have to make a distinction between what's called free testosterone and bound testosterone. And most of the testosterone in the blood is bound to these molecules, either.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that so the people will understand?
So elaborate in what specific area?
On those two types of testosterone.
Yeah, so the bound testosterone, it's kind of used up. It's not available to do anything, and it's bound usually to either albumin or to a binding molecule called SHBG, sex hormone binding globulin. And, you know, generally if a doctor tests the blood for testosterone, they're going to look at overall levels. And that was one of the things that made this field kind of really difficult to develop for a long time, because physicians would say, well, no, the testosterone level in the man hasn't changed at all. It's exactly the same. But researchers, you know, all these guys kept saying, yeah, but we don't feel right. There's something's happening. And so finally, some researchers began to look more deeply at it, and they found that while these overall levels remain the same, the amount of free testosterone begins to shift considerably. And the second thing that they found that begins to happen is that the ratio of androgens, which are the male hormones, to estrogens, which are more female hormones, considered more female hormones, that ratio begins to shift in middle age as well. We begin to shift more toward the estrogenic side of the equation. So those two things were found to be real consistent in middle age, and there's very few physicians, even with all the literature on it now, that actually are aware of this or would know how to test for it.
So where would what would someone do?
I'm not a big fan of getting tests from physicians and things like that. You know, a lot of people that really works for them, I'm kind of the guy that if 1% of the people that the pharmaceutical won't work for, I always fall in that group. So I kind of stay away from that. And the people I work with, I tend to go more toward how they feel. That's the thing that's most important. And there's certain dynamics you can tell. Is their libido low? Are they having erectile problems? Is their energy really low? Does their skin take a long time to heal? Are they having difficulty in sleeping? There's a lot of dynamics that you can look at, so you don't really need to look at blood tests. However, if that's what somebody wants to do, you know, the internet is a great tool. You basically get on there and just start searching for physicians that are specialists in testosterone replacement therapy, and you'll be able to find them, and they will do all the tests you would ever want to have that way.
I just want to mention this. In your book, you talk about some of the symptoms or the things you can get relief from to know if you have it. Is your level of energy lower? It lowers your obesity from the waist to hip ratio, because a lot of people have that problem.
A lot of people do.
Which has to do with heart disease and also diabetes.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that also most people aren't aware of is fat cells. Like in our culture now, the way that our diet is set up and with television and the advertising, and people tend to eat a lot of starches, for instance, and they tend to start building up excess fat levels in their body. And one of the problems that people run into then is that fat cells actually produce hormones. They're an endocrine agent, just like a lot of different things in the body, and they produce estrogenic chemicals, which further shifts the balance of the equation toward the estrogenic side. So you get that, you know, that hip-waist ratio thing going, you get more body fat going, and that it kind of starts this cycle that it's very difficult to stop, which is the reason why I have a 10-week low-fat cleansing diet in here. Just if you can get, for a lot of men who have a lot of excess body weight, if they can get their body fat levels down, that'll really help with estrogenic excess in the body considerably.
Interesting. And so how does that testosterone connect heart disease and prostate issues and diabetes? How does it connect?
Well, the diabetes, I haven't actually looked at that in a while, though I have looked at it in detail. The pancreas starts reacting oddly under a number of different conditions, and it could be, if there's too much sugar in the blood continually, it starts to kind of become desensitized. And it's a complex kind of a chemical relationship there that does get really involved. And heart disease is a little bit more clear in my memory because I've been looking at it more recently. The thing about heart disease is the heart is one of the most powerful muscles in the body, and all of the muscle tissues in the body, they're made to produce testosterone at the site where the testosterone is needed. And testosterone is used to enhance muscle mass and strength. So as the testosterone levels in the body go down, what happens is all of the muscles begin to lose a lot of their strength, and it's harder to keep muscle mass up. And that begins to affect heart disease itself. I mean, you start to see an increase in heart disease in middle age for that. That's just one of the factors, but it's an important one for men.
Of course, because the heart's a muscle.
Yes.
People don't think about that. It seems to me like that would also help urinary incontinence, particularly in women.
Having more testosterone?
Yeah, because it has to do with that muscle there, opening and closing.
Well, there is that particular muscle. That, you know, the sphincter muscle, I've actually found that the best herb for tone in the sphincter muscle, if there's kind of that minor incontinence that a lot of people, women and men, which I experienced for a while in middle age, is as I was shifting, is mullein root is extremely good as a tincture for that. And I've had a number of people that used it with their relatives in nursing homes with a lot of success. So it seems to work to really tone that muscle.
What was that? I've never heard of
mullein,
that.
Mullein root.
How do you spell that?
It's a very pervasive, it was a European transplant that came over here, and it's used, the leaves or the flowers are used a lot in ear oils for children, but the root is actually extremely good for that.
How do you spell that?
M-U-L-L-E-I-N, I believe.
And how would you take that?
Take it as a tincture, a full dropper full of the tincture 3 times a day.
Interesting. What about zinc?
Zinc is an incredibly important. If there's one supplement that men should really focus on getting enough of in their diet or during the day, it's really zinc. I mean, zinc is involved. Testosterone itself can't be produced without zinc. There's a zinc-dependent enzyme that the body uses to produce testosterone. It's extremely important in fertility, for sperm production, for erections. I mean, you just can't get away from it in every part of the male reproductive dynamic, and testosterone levels, zinc is essential. And that's one of the reasons why oysters have been considered an aphrodisiac, because they tend to concentrate zinc levels in their bodies. So in the past, if men would be zinc depleted and they would eat oysters, they'd have a fairly rapid return of sexual function from doing that. So zinc is really, really crucial.
Now, your book also talks about, I want to cover these two, because most people, the doctors, never tell you anything about these few things that you talked about, vitamin B and andro. What is the importance of that?
Well, the doctors aren't really taught to look at wellness. I mean, you know, the interesting thing I've got, there's this editor of a magazine, he's been wanting me to do a series on healthcare in the United States, and, you know, it's such a huge can of worms to even open that. I mean, how do you do something less than a million words on the problem? And everybody knows the system is broken. I have never met anybody that said, "Wow, I had a great time at the doctor yesterday." I mean, they don't say that. It's not fun. And occasionally I meet people who have had some weird disease or they're in a car wreck, and when they get in this kind of crisis dynamic, sometimes they find physicians that can really help. But when you get into these kinds of things, the physicians just aren't trained to spend a lot of time in medical school, but that's not what they do. They don't spend time understanding the role of vitamins. There's still many physicians groups that don't think supplements work at all, and they're very opposed to them. There's many of them that think herbs are quackery and don't work, in spite of thousands of clinical studies showing that they do work. So, you know, they're just in kind of a different focus. So, you know, in looking at this dynamic, I wanted to give kind of an overview of what the field was really showing would help, to look both at kind of newer, more scientifically oriented studies, as well as looking at long-term herbal use and what people had found, and had those long-term herbal use dynamics been borne out in clinical studies and in actual practice. And that's kind of what I put in there. And it turned out that a number of the B vitamins, for instance, are extremely important in keeping male reproductive health high. Or, for instance, like vitamin C is extremely important to keep sperm motility at a high enough level for fertility to occur. When vitamin C levels in the body are really low, the sperm tend to clump together, they agglutinate, and so they don't have that swimming motility that they have. So most physicians just simply aren't aware of this stuff. They're not trained in it. They're not interested in it. It's just not what they do. So, you know, I don't agree with the way the medical practice is in the country. We spend more on health care than any other industrialized nation on earth, and yet our outcomes are the same as Cuba, which spends $250 a year per person, they spend one of the least amounts of anybody in the world. So it's just, there's obviously the system's broken. And it's been a long time since I've actually thought of physicians as competent healthcare professionals. It's just after 20 years of doing this, they're just not trained in it. And people expect them to be, but it's just, the expectation's never going to be met.
I think most of us have finally understood that it's all about big pharma making money.
It is. You know, most people don't understand that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were 11 different kinds of physicians practicing in the United States, and the kind we call doctors now were just one of those groups, and they were all competing groups with each other. And this particular group, the allopaths, they made a deal with the pharmaceutical companies to accept advertising in the Journal of the American Medical Association in the early 1900s, and they used that money to then fund, and they got a considerable amount of money. I mean, they make millions from that now, and they used that money to fund legal lobbying action in every state to eventually get all other forms of medical care outlawed. And, you know, it's been changing. You know, the chiropractors, it took them, 30 or 40 or 50 years to become legal again in every state. And then midwives were outlawed. Now they've come back. So it's been a slow change of that. But the thing they did, they made a pact with big pharmacy back then, and that pact is firmly in place now. They basically are drug dispensers for pharmaceutical companies. I wish it wasn't so, but
I do too. I hate it. I really do. How important would you say that it would be when you're taking these supplements, whether it's DHEA or the vitamin B or the zinc, that you take an organic supplement instead of a pharmaceutical compound?
That actually, there's some debate on that particular issue, and really, one of the great kind of herbal writers these days is a guy named Jim Duke, who lives in Maryland. He worked for the USDA for most of his life, and he wrote a great book called The Green Pharmacy, and he talks in there a lot about, he said he would rather eat his medicine any day of the week, and he's, you know, put a lot of material together about what foods to eat, and actually, you think about it, human beings have been emerging out of the Earth ecosystem for a very long time, and we're used to eating those supplements, to getting them from natural plant products for the most part in our diet, our, you know, even in special plants that we might eat at certain times of the year that aren't available other times. And so our bodies do tend to take in those forms better. They tend to take in through eating oysters, for instance, better than taking a supplement. The problem is, with the lifestyle most people have, it's difficult for them to go a completely natural way like that. And so, you know, any kind of supplement is, in general, going to be, and that's not always true, but in general, it's going to be better than these others. Now, better than nothing at all. But then you'll also notice that some supplements, like, for instance, L-arginine and L-carnitine, those two supplements are extremely important in male reproductive health. And that L before them, that means it's the same kind of form that the body naturally produces. So in that particular instance, if you can get that natural form, that's what I recommend that people get. The body recognizes it better and uses it much more easily.
Where would you get the natural form for those things?
Well, you know, I'm a big internet fan, just simply because at health food stores, a lot of these things are so tremendously expensive that only like rich yuppies can afford them, you know. And
mm-hmm.
it's just, you know, I've known people to spend thousands and thousands of dollars on these things. So the neat thing about the internet, if you could do a Google search on any supplement you're looking for, you actually can do comparison pricing and find extremely good deals on these from, you know, reputable places. And that's what I recommend people do. It just saves them the money, and they might as well do that.
But tell us a little, that was going to be one of my questions. Tell us about L-arginine, L-phenylalanine, and L-tyrosine, and what their relationship is to the prostate health and testosterone.
Well, okay. Can do that a little bit. For instance,
Because most people, a lot of people have never heard of those things. So
yeah, and then again, these are, you know, and I do want to make sure I want to talk about some of the plants, too, because that's really, you know, more my area of expertise. But, you know, a number of these things, what I was doing was really looking in the literature to make sure, you know, to find all of the different things that were effective that people could do that any of the studies had shown. And so it turned out that there was a number of these things like L-arginine that was extremely good for health, like when you're looking at infertility, for instance. Some of these things, like L-arginine, it's an amino acid that's been present in the body, and it's an essential amino acid needed for, you know, replication of cells. It's really important in sperm production. And so it turns out that just a lot of people that would have low sperm production or low sperm motility, that their L-arginine levels would be low.
So they would probably have a problem with wound healing and their immune system?
That's also really common in middle-aged men anyway. So you'll find, L-carnitine, you know, there's this structure at the back of the testicles called the epididymis, and it's extremely high in L-carnitine, and they, you know, that L-carnitine is needed for the epididymis to work with sperm production and a lot of other things. So I outline all of these things in the books, and I look at the different studies that were conducted and, you know, the kind of impacts that they made. And where possible, I tried to find clinical trials. So, you know, there'd be like 47 men would be given these supplements, and 37 of them would show increased fertility. So just to kind of give people an idea of the effectiveness in the real world.
Another thing that you do in this book, which I think is really great, is you give suggested herbs and their dosages and how often you should take them and how to combine them to make them effective. So I'm not going to ask you the specific dosages, but people can find that in the book.
Yeah, you know, and I wanted to have, you know, at the beginning of every section of the book, just a little kind of sidebar piece that just outlined the protocol for raising testosterone levels, are for increasing fertility. I mean, male infertility is more of a problem than people realize because there's so many toxic chemicals in the environment now, and there's a huge body of research showing that a lot of our male health and our testosterone levels is being affected by these chemicals in the environment that either interfere with testosterone production, or they put estrogenic-like substances in our body so they affect the balance between estrogen and testosterone. And so this has been a really big problem, and infertility rates in all male species around the world have been increasing for quite some time. So in that kind of thing, when, you know, there's, when somebody has that kind of problem like infertility and they're looking for something, it's really nice to be able to just open the book and then you see a little sidebar and it says, take these and these and these. And if you want to look for more detail in the book, it's certainly there.
Is it more important of whether the levels are high or low or the balance between the two?
Both of them seem to be really important. The free testosterone levels need to be within a certain range, and the ratio or the balance between the testosterone and the estrogen, or the androgens and estrogens, needs to be within a certain range. It's really both of those things. And, for instance, a lot of men have prostate problems now, and very, very in-depth research on that has shown that, you know, the prostate, in a sense, the prostate is the male version of the womb. It's that organ that's transformed during male development and becomes the prostate. And both the womb and the prostate are extremely sensitive to endocrine chemicals, testosterone, androgens, estrogens. And so there's this kind of balancing dynamic that is supposed to occur in the prostate tissues to keep it healthy. And when that starts getting out of whack, because of you know, too much estrogen, for instance, being produced inside the prostate, you start to get prostate enlargement and prostate cancers of really specific types. So that's why certain plants like saw palmetto, which is a very, very good plant for prostate malfunction, it's an endocrine normalizer. So when men take it, those chemicals in the plant are actually sent directly to the prostate where they begin to normalize the androgen-estrogen balance. So, you know, when you look in there, you'll see these different parts of the body that respond either to the higher levels or the particular balance in there, and so both are crucially important.
That's very interesting. You also talked about pine pollen, which amazed me. I was shocked about that.
Well, most people have heard of you know, phytoestrogens or plants that contain estrogen. The women's movement that kind of really picked up steam in the 60s and the 70s, you know, they weren't really getting a lot of satisfaction going to conventional physicians. And they began to research a lot of this stuff. And so the body of work around plants that contain estrogenic substances is really well developed. But the whole concept of phytoandrogens, that is, plants that contain male hormones, is really in its infancy. And I was shocked, even being in the field as long as I have, that nobody had ever done any work along this. And so I began looking at that. That was a big point for me, like, can we develop a body of knowledge about plants containing male hormones? And in fact, they do exist. They're fairly pervasive in nature. It's just that nobody's done any research on them. It's very new. And one of the major plants that I came across was pine pollen. And the pine itself contains testosterone molecularly identical to that we have in our male bodies and a number of other male hormones as well. And it's highest in the pine pollen itself. And so it turns out that pine pollen has been used in China and Asia for thousands of years as an anti-aging agent to increase male vitality and fertility. But unlike ginseng, for instance, which has become very popular over here, nobody's really done anything with the pollen. And I began to look more in the studies and found out that the pine pollen itself has extremely high levels of testosterone compared to what's even normal in our bodies. And so I began working with some local people in New England who harvest it every year and make the tincture. And so that's one of the major things I've used for, almost 10 years now for myself and other people, and it works extremely well.
Where will you get the biggest benefit from it? I mean, is it going to be for the prostate issues or for your sexuality issues?
Overall male vitality and sexuality in general, the functioning of your energy levels and libido will go up almost immediately as you start taking it. And it'll help with a number of other specific reproductive problems as well, like erectile dysfunction responds really well to it. So the neat thing about it is when you can get it, there's a company that's just started producing or importing tablets into the United States, and they're selling on eBay now, which is where they first set up things, and their quality is really good. But the tablets it's more of an overall health kind of thing for the whole system. The tincture is really what's needed for enhancing testosterone levels, because when you take a tincture and you put it on your tongue and then you swallow it, it goes through those mucous membrane systems in the mouth and the throat directly into the bloodstream. So what you get is a really quick testosterone surge in the bloodstream, which is what you're needing. And so immediately energy levels go up, libido increases, and it's especially nice when men are just going into that midlife shift and they're experiencing all of the kind of transition difficulties that occur as they're going through that change. It will help even out that shift until they get to the other side. And I've just found its impacts are pretty remarkable.
It sounds profound. How do you know if you take too much, though?
I don't know if you could. It's I've never actually heard of anybody do that, and I'm not aware of any contraindications for dosage. The Chinese, for instance, the Koreans are even a better example. Some of the cultures around them call them the pine pollen people over there, and they have for many, many years, it's starting to change a little now, but they would sell pine pollen in their supermarkets in boxes like we sell baking soda. And the Chinese, as well as the Koreans, they cook with it in their food. It's a primary substance that they use. And they would eat, ounces and ounces of it every day, sometimes just straight as teas and cooked in muffins and all different kinds of things. And there's no, there's very rarely, very occasionally, some people have sensitivity to pine pollen just because they have pollen sensitivities. But I've never seen any contraindications for dosage on that at all. It's more of a food than anything else.
We've got about 20 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about diet and things that you should stay away from and then things that you should lean towards prostatitis or prostate cancer.
Yeah, we could look at some prostate stuff and things like that. The food stuff and the stuff to stay away from, I think, is really fascinating. Now, I was talking a little bit about pine pollen there, and pine is a wind-pollinated plant rather than an insect-pollinated plant. And it turns out a number of the pollinated plants tend to have testosterone in their pollen. Another one is corn pollen, which is very difficult. You can't get it. Cattail pollen as well, which is a little easier to get, but they're not included specifically in the book because there isn't any source for them. But corn, for instance, is extremely good to consume for health of the adrenal glands, and because it'll help enhance testosterone levels. But probably the best plant of all that I found is celery, and it's really, truly an amazing plant for this. It contains a number of androgen analogs. That is, the chemical structure is nearly identical to androgens that a lot of male animals have. And also, it's got a chemical constituent in it called apigenin, which it interferes with the conversion of testosterone to estrogens. Testosterone is not a final end product chemical. It can actually be converted to an even more powerful androgen called DHT, or it can be converted into estradiol, which is the strongest female estrogen hormone. And what happens in the body, for instance, when fat levels get really high, it begins to be converted, testosterone gets to be converted into more female hormones. That's part of what occurs. Well, if you consume plants or foods that stop it from being converted to estrogens, it'll be converted into more powerful androgenic chemicals. And celery is just really extremely good for that. And it's good for high blood pressure. It's good for a lot of things. So, I recommend that people juice 4 stalks of celery a day. I mean, that over a month-long period of time will do a huge amount to increase energy levels and overall well-being.
Just the stalk of celery? It doesn't have to be the seeds or...
No, it doesn't have to be. I mean, celery seed is really good for urinary tract infections, for instance. The whole plant responds well to the reproductive system overall, the genital urinary system. But no, the stalk, 4 celery stalks are extremely good.
How much would it lower a blood pressure typically?
I don't remember the exact amount. I've got it in another book I wrote called Vital Man, where I look at that specifically. But it's something like it'll go down 15 points or something
wow.
like that.
And how long does it take it to?
It doesn't take any time at all.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and if you add it in as a regular part of your diet, and I have a recipe for a nice green drink to try every morning, so it's very reliable in helping that way.
Now, does it matter how fresh it is, how long it's been sitting on the grocery store itself?
Celery, it tends to wilt pretty quick, so those things, with stuff like that, I tend to buy organic pretty exclusively because I don't want any trace chemicals coming in. which can really affect testosterone levels. There's a lot of pesticides and fertilizer residues that actually have a lot of heavy impacts on testosterone levels. So with food, I tend to go really organic when I'm working on something like this. And I've found the celery to be pretty fresh in most of the stores.
I have to ask this question. What do you think about genetically modified seeds?
I think that scientists don't understand enough to be meddling. I mean, I was reading an article today where they're really wanting to develop human-animal hybrids, you know, and I just think, you know,
these are just not
some of the bright. And, you know, they know some things, but there's just certain things. We're not smart enough to begin fooling around with this stuff until we know what the outcome was going to be. We weren't even smart enough to figure out how to work with the environment with cutting off trees and stuff, much less something like this. So I'm not a big fan of it. I'm not as worried about it as a lot of activists because nature tends to self-correct these things, but I'm not a big fan of it either.
Tell us a little bit about the things that people should avoid. What kinds of foods if they have problems?
Well, the primary number one thing men should avoid if they, you know, that are going through middle age is hopped beer. And it's not the alcohol or the beer per se, it's the hops. And hops is the most powerful estrogenic plant on the face of the earth. It's the Germans have done a lot of work, very sophisticated about plant medicinals, and one of the things that they discovered a number of years ago was that, for instance, that young women who would go into the fields to pick hops, they would tend to enter their menstrual cycles many years before they should, and it turns out that the hops estrogenic chemicals are absorbed through the skin while they were picking them, and so they did a lot of studies on it, and it turns out that if a man drinks, for instance, 6 beers of an evening, that is enough to completely counteract direct testosterone injections into the bloodstream. So
that's
it's a very potent herb, and there's actually even a condition in England known as brewer's droop because of the brewers having difficulty in getting erections because they've taken into their body so many of these estrogenic compounds from the plants over the years. So that's the absolute number one thing, and it's possible to get beers that don't have hops in them, and I highly recommend that. So another substance is licorice, which is also used in dark beers for as a sweetener and also to increase head on the beer, and it actually is very powerfully estrogenic as well. Black cohosh, which is a plant some people use for muscle spasms, it's not good for men in middle age. And cottonseed oil is extremely bad for men. It's used in a lot of solid lard substitutes, and then not that many people use it anymore, but actually it'll shut down testosterone production pretty much completely in the male.
One more thing I just thought about. What about, we didn't touch on depression.
Serotonin. Depression is a real problem for everybody that goes into middle age. You know, a big part of it is, you think about it, when we become adolescents, the child that we were is never going to come back. And adolescents, they're so excited to finally be big enough to go out in the world and do stuff, they don't think about it a lot. But there's a natural grieving process that's incredibly important there. A lot of adolescents, when they talk to you about what's going on with them, they tend to gesture to the region of the chest a lot. It kind of indicates there's, you know, a problem with this kind of loss that they're just not aware of. And it's much more significant, I think, in middle age, because truly, in a way, our mortality is really catching up with us. And we're realizing that young person we were is never going to come back. And we aren't really given enough time to really grieve that process. In our culture, really have any kind of guidance through it, just from how we deal with it as a people. So depression is extremely heavy for a number of people going into middle age, and they tend to wake up at 3 a.m. to think about all the things that didn't work out, and it's a tough problem. So the things that I generally recommend to people is to really take time to go through this process. And I talk a little bit about it in this book, though it's not the whole focus of it. The second thing is frequent massages. Swedish massages are extremely helpful for this. They help immune function and lymph function and a whole lot of things as well. But probably the most basic thing we respond to as a species is the touch of a caring person. And with that kind of depression, you know, it's just very, very important. And also, you know, some of these herbs will help, like Eleutherococcus. It used to be known as Siberian ginseng. It's extremely helpful to take during this period. It's very good for helping vitality, energy levels, mental clarity, but also it's very good with helping with that particular kind of depression. So those are my general kind of off-the-cuff things that I recommend to most people.
What about the connection between phenylalanine and tyrosine with dopamine and serotonin?
Well, that, you know, that stuff, I've met some people that have had good success with that and others which haven't. And so, I mean, it's like a lot of things. When you get into it that, you know, that's why there's so many herbs and so many supplements, and some of them really, really work for people, and others just, they're not quite the right thing. So the things I tended to talk about were the things that I felt were the ones I'd had the most success with
okay.
over time.
Well, tell us one more time, for the people that got in late, where to find you and this information. Because you list in the book, I just want people to know, you give diet, you give dosages, you give regimens about toxicity and cleansings that they can do. So it's a really, really good book.
Thanks. And probably the two other plants we didn't mention that are really the most important are nettle root, which nettle root is specific for increasing testosterone levels, but it's also specific for keeping the prostate healthy. And there's been, you know, just lots and lots of work with it in Germany, for instance, as a primary treatment for prostate inflammation. It's really, really effective. So for the male reproductive system, it's one of the best things. And the other one is this plant called Tribulus terrestris. It's an invasive botanical, which I always think is interesting because for most diseases that are real common now, I find there's some invasive botanical that's come in that's really good for it. It's known as puncture vine because it'll puncture your feet or, you know, bicycle tires. It's really intense.
Wow.
But those seeds are extremely good for increasing fertility and erection and for testosterone levels. So those are really good as well. And so, and in any event, to answer your question directly about where people can find me, I have a website, GaianStudies.org, GaianStudies.org. And usually if people just type in my name on the Internet, my website will come up anyway. And
so Stephen with a P-H.
Stephen with a P-H and then Buhner, B as in boy, U-H-N-E-R.
The Natural Testosterone Plan. Stephen, thanks so much. It's a great book.
Oh, thanks very much for
having
me. I'm
going to give it to all my men friends.
Great, thanks.
Thanks for coming on, and maybe you can come back sometime and talk about your other book.
That'd be great.
I'd love to have you. Thank you, and agape to you. Good night.